Here we are in Exodus chapter 3, and let's begin with just a note from the end of chapter 2. When Moses says he has a son, he's in Midian, and in verse 22 and following, Moses calls his son's name Gershom, for he says, "I have been a sojourner or a stranger in a foreign land." And during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, "I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go up to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent you me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now, please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God.' But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians." Then Moses answered, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He said, "A staff." And he said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, "Put your hand inside your cloak." And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand back inside your cloak. So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it out on the dry ground, and the water that you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. But Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Then the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. But he said, oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do the signs. May God add his blessing to this reading from his holy and inspired word. What do you think if Moses was giving a job satisfaction survey? Kind of rate yourself. How's this going? What do you think Moses would be saying? What was Moses saying in chapter 2? I'm a stranger in a foreign land. Think about what he's doing. He grew up in Egypt. Now, we know from the latter part of Genesis that shepherds were despised by the Egyptians. That was a lowly profession. No one wanted to do it. It's stinky. It's cold and it's hot and it's smelly and it's unrewarding and it's a dead end career path. And you just don't want to be there. And Moses, of all people, grew up in the palace of Pharaoh. By God's amazing providence, Moses was whisked into there. He was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and he grew up not only being an Egyptian, but being one of the most powerful Egyptians in his culture. So he started off way, 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 way up here, and very shortly, he's way down here. He's gone from about as high as he could have ever imagined in a miraculous way to being pretty much in the lowest place. Not only is he a shepherd, he's a shepherd in a foreign land. Not only is he a shepherd in a foreign land, but he's tending someone else's flocks. And 40 years later, it's still Jethro's flock. Do you see that in the beginning of the chapter? After 40 years, he's tending Jethro's flock. Now, remember Joseph, or we're going to read as Pastor Wood goes through Genesis, you're going to see, Jacob. Jacob moves away and starts working for his brother-in-law, Laban. And he works for him to get married, and then he works for him to pay for his second wife, and then he works for him a little longer, and Laban changes his wages a bunch of times and cheats him, and at the end of this, Jacob launches in this big tirade about how he's been treated, and you changed my wages, and I couldn't sleep, and it was cold, and it was miserable, and it was blah, 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 blah. But after 20 years, Jacob's got his own flocks and herds. God's blessed him, and he's got stuff. He has two wives, he has a bunch of children, and he has a lot of flocks and herds. Moses, after 40 years, is still tending his father-in-law's sheep. It isn't going as well. And he started way higher than Jacob. Jacob went to Laban with nothing, was leaving with a lot of stuff, and was complaining about it. Moses left a whole lot of stuff for nothing, and after 40 years, he still got nothing. And he used to have some hope. You know, earlier in this, he thought, Stephen gives us a little insight into this, Moses thought he was delivering, God was using him to deliver the people of Israel. He thought, God must have brought me to this place for a reason, not unlike Mordecai telling Esther, who knows, but God has put you in this position for such a time as this. And Moses thinks, God must have put me in the palace to rescue the Israelites, and this is amazing, and I'm going to do it. And he sees this Egyptian, and he pounds him in the dirt, and the next day, instead of things going well, they go really, really, really badly, about as badly as they could. He has to flee for his life. But he wanted to deliver the Israelites. And now, 40 years later, God comes and says, guess what? The dream, now that's going to become a reality. And what Moses says is, not anymore. I used to think that. I used to hope for that. That used to be kind of heavy on my heart. It used to be something I really thought was going to happen. And now, could you just Did you pick somebody else? Have you ever felt like that? Has there ever been something you wanted or you thought God was going to do and you thought it was going to happen and then it didn't? And then you wait a long, long, long time and then suddenly God opens it up, or it may not have opened it up yet. You may still be in year 27 of tending your father-in-law's sheep, and you're wondering, when's God going to open that up? And the answer is, I really don't know. I don't know that. Moses didn't know that. There's no hint that after 40 years, Moses got up and thought, you know, ding, this morning, this is the day. I kind of had it on my calendar. You know, I've known that God was going to deliver us. I just knew it was going to happen. And now, you know, he got up that morning thinking it was going to be great. He got up that morning like every other morning. It's one more morning of tending my father-in-law's sheep, and I've been doing this for 40 years, so long that I've kind of given up on the dream, and it's really over, and I'm used to this. This is my role now. This is what I do. I'm going to do this until I die. I'm a stranger in a foreign land. It's not my stuff, and it's okay. And Moses has finally given up, and it's at that point that God says, okay, now you're somebody I can work with. The only inkling that we have, God chooses people for various things, and the only inkling that we have is from Paul in the letters of 1 Corinthians, the first chapter. What he says is, God doesn't choose the strong, he doesn't choose the wise, he doesn't choose the powerful. He chooses the ones who are weak and foolish and are not, so that God gets all the glory. The one inkling that we have on why God chooses to do what God does is so that God will get the glory. And that's something, if there's one thing that comes through in this chapter, it's that it's all about God. Moses is sitting here thinking this is about me, or he may not be thinking it's about me, but certainly the Israelites were. They're saying, don't you know what's going on? And God says, yes. As a matter of fact, I told Abraham that this was going to happen. Before it ever started, I knew it was going on. I kind of planned it that way. And he planned it that way for a purpose. And it wasn't because he's mean and capricious. It's because God wants to be God. And that's the best thing for us. The very best thing we can have is for a God who really is God. And for us to realize we're not. So the Israelites are suffering. Moses is having a bad day. But in another sense, it's just like every other day. And he leads his flock into the wilderness. And he sees something that's very strange. Verse 2. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet was not consumed. Now there may be people, Pastor Wood points this out often, strange commentators who look at things like this and say, well, people believe that in primitive times, you know, it would have been a primitive thought to think that there could be a bush that burns. And we know now scientifically that's not possible because we understand the conservation of matter and energy. Now, if you've heard of the conservation of matter and energy, you can turn matter into energy. And in some cases, you can turn energy into matter, but you always have the same, the amount of energy in a closed system is finite. It doesn't increase, it doesn't decrease, it's always the same. It's the first law of thermodynamics. Are you all with me? Everybody's nodding your head. Yeah, I'm into the thermodynamics. I know what you're talking about. That's a mouthful. All right, what on earth is he talking about? We're talking about the fact that you can burn something and create energy, but when you create energy, you have less stuff. The thing you burned is gone. And the point of this being in the passage is that Moses knew that. Moses is 80 years old. He's seen fires before. And what he knows is when you have a fire, it burns the thing up. That's why this was unusual. He looks at this bush. He says, what's going on? I've never seen anything like this before. The bush is on fire. And I keep watching, waiting for it to wither up. And it doesn't. We've had a fun experience. Some very generous neighbors of ours gave us a Christmas tree this year, which we enjoyed, and we had it in our house. And I was amazed. I had no idea what a fire hazard they were until after Christmas in January. We're trying to figure out what are we going to do with this Christmas tree and get rid of it. And my wife has a bright idea and in this amazing display of redneckishness. We're going to cut it up and burn it in our stove. And so you see this tree being just, you know, snipped apart, and it looks less and less like a Christmas tree and more like something that ought to be in the dump. But it's still in our living room, and she's just snipping limbs off of it and throwing it in there. And I tell you what, it was like fireworks. I had no idea. But we put this thing in our stove, and it's like, you know, it's better than paper. It's better than cardboard. It's just, if you want to start a fire, try a pine tree. So anyway, this probably wasn't a pine bush, but just as an aside, I can speak from recent firsthand experience. Bushes burn, and when they're burned, they're gone. And so Moses is looking at this thing, and he's thinking, I've never seen anything like this before. What's going on? Well, what is going on is that God is demonstrating something that is also embodied in the name that he gives Moses. When Moses asks, "Who am I supposed to say sent me?" And God says, "Tell them I am sent you. I am that I am." What God is saying is, I am the self-existent one. Everything else you've ever seen in your life was created. There's no person, there's no place, there's no thing that I didn't create. I made all of it, but I don't depend on any of it. I'm the only thing in the universe that exists by itself and that isn't dependent on all the others. And that's, in a sense, what God is demonstrating for Moses there. Who's able to make a fire that doesn't consume anything? Only God. And so God comes and he appears to Moses, and he appears to him in a way to tell Moses, "Moses, I am a God like no other. Your father-in-law may be the priest of Midian, but I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." The Egyptians worship all sorts of other little gods, but I'm the real God. And he does that for Moses in a way that's memorable. And we don't get any inkling that Moses knew on the calendar that it was going to happen that day. This was just like every other day in a long, 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 long period of Moses gradually losing hope that things are ever going to change. And all of a sudden, when Moses has really pretty well given up, God comes and he says to Moses, "I've seen and I'm going to do something." Now, look at the centrality when we talk about God being about himself. Look at what God says to him. First of all, that God's holy. It's demonstrated there. He says to him, "Take off your feet." Take off your feet. That'd be amazing in itself, wouldn't it? No, that's not what he did. "Take off your sandals. Take off your sandals, for the place you're standing is holy." We need to emphasize here, we learn two things about God. One is we learn that God cares. He's compassionate. He looks at the Israelites and he knows their suffering. Have you ever wondered if God cares? God makes it very clear he cares about their suffering. But he also makes it clear that he's holy. And we don't just walk into his presence like we would anyone else's. He is unlike us. And so the emphasis, what we find is there's generally in our thinking an unbalanced view of God. We tend toward one or the other. God is holy, and we emphasize God's holiness to the detriment of his compassion, or we emphasize God's compassion if we forget that he's holy. And what God is demonstrating to Moses is that he's both. He's more compassionate than we've ever imagined, but he's also more unlike us than we've ever imagined. He's more powerful than we've ever imagined. And both of those are in the text, and both of those are things that we have to hold to. And we generally get stuck in this tension that if God is powerful enough to fix things, why doesn't he? He must not be loving. Or God is loving, but he must not be powerful enough to fix it, because surely a loving God would change things, and he doesn't. And so we get stuck in this theological tension where we can't reconcile, is God loving or is God holy? And the fact is, God is both. Both are in this passage, but God is doing something that is more than about these people. He's doing something that's about himself. And the thrilling part of that, though they had no idea, is that the suffering, one of the things that we want to know about suffering is it worth it? You ask the question, we're always calculating that, is it going to be worth what I go through? We want to know on the front end, is this going to be worth it? And if you tell us it's worth it, we'll do it. Professional athletes put themselves through unbelievable things, but they do it with the hope that they're going to be the best in the world. And to them, they've counted the cost and they've decided it's worth it. God calls on us to have faith that he's worth it without telling us ahead of time how it's going to turn out for us. And what we need to be convinced of is that God is worth it, whether or not it turns out well for us in this life or not. And so God is about to do something with them that is completely unprecedented. And the fact is, we're talking about it now after thousands of years. Thousands of years later, the suffering of the Israelites, would we say that it was worth it? I think it was worth it because it's transformed every generation in human history. No suffering has been used maybe as much as this, unless it's the suffering of Jesus, to speak to us about God. So when you're asking yourself, is it worth it? Tell yourself it is. Whatever you're going through, it's worth it if God gets the glory. And so God speaks to Moses, and he tells Moses what he really needs to hear, that God himself is going to act, and it's really not about them. That's the beginning of the very famous and in many ways helpful book from Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Church. The first line in there is it's not about you. And part of why that was such a transformational book for so many people is because if there's anything we need to hear over and over and over again, is that it's not about us. And I'm not saying everything else in there is transformational, but that line really was and is. And Moses hears that, and listen to what God says. He says, I have, in verse 7, you can counter underline these things. The Lord says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people in Egypt. I know their sufferings. I have come down to deliver them. In verse 9, he says, I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. In verse 10, come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people out. In verse 12, he says, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you. You'll worship on this mountain. He says in verse 14, I am who I am. He says in verse 16, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. 17, I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt. In verse 20, so I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. Verse 19, but I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go. Verse 21, I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. What Moses needs to understand is that God isn't asking Moses to go do something on his own. Try again. You know, I know you didn't succeed the first time, but go try again and maybe it'll work out better. God is saying, I'm going to do something fundamentally different. I am going to bring them out. It doesn't depend on you. It depends on me. And that's good. And we need to be reminded of that. If we're walking with God and doing what God's called us to do, the outcome doesn't depend on us. It depends on God. That's very freeing. If I think it's all about me, then it, you know, probably isn't going to work out too well. I could tell you of spectacular failures in my life, but you wouldn't want to hear them. I'm sure. I trust you have a few of your own. If it depends on God, it's going to happen. And that's what God is saying to Moses. And he says to him that he is the self-existent God. He is unlike every other created thing. He's going to work it out, and it's going to be for his own glory, and it's going to be really good. Moses has all sorts of objections. You know, I'm not smart enough. I don't speak well enough. They won't believe me. And God begins to speak to him about all these objections and answer each one of those. And at the end of the thing here, he finally says, you know, I just can't talk very well. And God says something very good to him. He says, who made your mouth? He says, Moses, what are you saying about me? You know, who made your mouth? I did. You saying I made a bad mouth? I made your mouth exactly the way I wanted it. You can't talk. What are you saying about my work? That's what God is saying. We need to hear that. If you feel like Moses and saying, I can't do this or that, if God's telling you to do something and you're saying to yourself, well, I can't. Well, you may not be able to do that in your own power. But God, if you're participating with God in what God is doing, he doesn't expect you to do it in your own power. He expects you to walk in the Spirit. And his Spirit will empower you to do what God calls you to do. And we do well not to raise all these objections. So God gives him some miraculous signs to take with him. And we're going to see later just what those signs look like when Moses applies them. But I want to encourage you today, if you're feeling like that thing that you've hoped for a long time seems just as far away as it ever has, and you're wondering, is that going, when's it going to happen? I don't know. God may speak to you from a bush today, but if he does, it'll be only the second time in history that we're aware of. So I wouldn't go out expecting a bush to burst into flame. But neither would I go out not expecting God to speak to you. Moses probably didn't expect God to speak to him this morning, but he did. And unlike Moses, we've been given the Spirit of God. Jesus said that his Spirit will be in us, that he will remind us of what he said, that he will lead us into all truth, that he will convict the world of sin, that he will give us power to walk with him and to obey him. And so should we expect to hear from God? I would say yes. We should expect to hear from God daily. It may not be in a burning bush, and it may not be the transforming encounter that Moses experienced today. But we ought to expect that God will do things that are amazing. That's sort of what God is in the habit of doing. And let's read now to close those verses we alluded to in 1 Corinthians 1, and we'll close with that. Paul says, let's start in verse 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly or foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord.